This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and yes, it is Super Tuesday, everyone. In case you didn't already know that at this hour of the day, but polls are open today in Massachusetts, one of 13 states voting in Super Tuesday presidential primaries and caucuses around the country. In all, 865 delegates at stake for the Democrats, while the Republicans are competing for 595 delegates. And here in Massachusetts, there's a tight race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. And in the GOP contest, Donald Trump has been leading in the polls, raising the question if Massachusetts Republicans won't stop his march toward the Republican presidential nomination. Some people wonder who will. On the other hand, Trump's voters don't think anyone should stop him. So we're going to explore that a little later in this hour. So let's begin, though, with WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
So let's start with the Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. They spent part of yesterday campaigning in the state, as we talked about, a sign that Massachusetts is actually at play. So remind us what's at stake for both of them.
Okay, well, this is obviously most important for Bernie Sanders. He needs a win. He took that drubbing in South Carolina. And if he doesn't win in a state like Massachusetts, a very liberal state, it raises the question, where can he win? He's also hoping to do well in Minnesota, which is liberal. He's hoping to do well in Colorado, which is a caucus state, and of course in his home state of Vermont. We spoke to Sanders less than an hour ago, and he says the key for him today is voter turnout.
I believe that we will do very well if there is a large voter turnout. If working class people, many of whom have given up on the political process, don't see Washington doing anything for them, if they begin to stand up and fight back and come out and vote, if young people who have never been involved in the political process come out and vote, we're going to do just fine.
So, Meghna, he's hoping to get lots of people like Lucas Ferreira. I spoke to him yesterday. He's a college student. He was at a big rally last night at Milton High School, Sanders' final rally before Super Tuesday. Here's what Lucas Ferreira said.
So I'm a political science student over at Curry College. And I just think that the message Bernie spreads about equality and the domestic agenda really correlate with my own personal views and the views that I think have been successful historically for our society.
But here's the big question, Meghna. Lots of people have been coming out to these Sanders rallies. I think there were 3,600 people in Milton last night. But in primaries and caucuses so far, we haven't been seeing huge voter turnout like we did in 2008. So that remains a question for Sanders here in Massachusetts.
Oh, interesting. So what do we know about what voter turnout may be like in Massachusetts today?
Well, Secretary of State William Galvin predicted turnout could exceed 2008 levels. But a lot of that could be explained by the Donald Trump phenomenon. Because he told us that since January 1st, nearly 20,000 voters have left the Democratic Party either to become unenrolled or registering Republicans. So presumably they're being drawn into the race to vote for or against Donald Trump. So it's not clear yet how heavy voter turnout will affect the Democratic race.
Okay, so we heard a little bit from Bernie Sanders a second ago. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton. In the days leading up to today, she was polling ahead of Sanders. And so what's at stake for her?
Well, obviously she wants a win. She wants to add to her momentum. She had that big win in South Carolina. She's expected to do well across the South today. But she can afford to lose in Massachusetts and still come out in pretty good shape. Here in this state, her big advantage is with female voters, particularly with women voters over 50, who vote in large numbers and who favor her in a big way. Our most recent poll found that out. So she's counting on voters like Kathy Swain from Weymouth, who was at her rally in Boston yesterday. Here's what she said.
I think she has the ability to get it done. I think watching her on television, especially during her last set of Benghazi hearings, I've never seen anybody stay so even in my entire life under such distress. Here's someone who can really lead without losing their cool, not even a facial expression, never played her hand.
Well, let's turn now and talk about the Republicans. I mean, you mentioned the fact that there have been a lot of people leaving the Democratic Party in Massachusetts and becoming unenrolled or Republican voters for the state here. So let's talk about what stands out on this about the GOP race in Massachusetts.
Well, for me, it's this idea that a big win for Donald Trump in a state like Massachusetts bodes incredibly well for him. I mean, our polling showed that he has a big lead here among men, among women, among people of all ages, among all income groups, and across the entire state. And he's counting on support from people like Chad Pouris in Waltham, who voted for him this morning. Here's what he said.
He's not beholden to anyone, and it's time for a change. The other candidates are bought and paid for, and I think people are tired of that. And if the reality of it is he's going to bring discipline back to this country.
Now, if Trump does well here and in all the other states that he's been polling well in, he will have proven that he can put together victories in a broad range of states, from the Northeast through the South into the West, with evangelicals as well as non-religious voters. So it will be something to watch, and that's going to be one of the big things we'll be watching tonight.
Interesting. Well, Anthony Brooks is WBUR's senior political reporter. Anthony, we'll check back with you at the end of the hour, so thanks a lot.
Very good. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, let's check in with one of WBUR's reporters at polling places around Massachusetts, and let's begin in Dorchester with WBUR's Zininjor and Wemeka. Hi there, Zininjor.
Hi, Magna.
So you're at the Pauline Shaw Elementary School in Dorchester. Have you had a chance to talk to voters, and what are they saying?
Yes, I have. Yes, I'm here in Dorchester, and I've been talking to some voters who have been coming in, and I'm getting sort of a wide spectrum of reactions. I spoke to one gentleman who came in and said that he was supporting Bernie Sanders. He said that he just really feels that he is a candidate for a new generation and that he is more for the people. I also spoke to another woman who came in and, she said that she, really feels like the country needs a woman president. So for that reason, she's supporting Hillary Clinton and, she basically feels that Hillary Clinton, in her words, she said, makes the most sense, and she really liked her plans.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been an interesting mix.
Well, you just heard Anthony tell us that Secretary of State Bill Galvin has said that he expects high turnout today for this primary. How have you seen lines? Does it seem busy to you?
Yeah, so I'm here. It's about it's afternoon. It's not crowded. It's not packed at the Pauline Shaw Elementary School. About a little over 120 people have voted at this particular polling location so far. But I am being told that it has been a little busier today than in past primaries. So far it's been I've seen a steady stream of people coming in to cast their ballot.
Well, that's WBUR's Zininjor and Wemeka reporting to us from Dorchester. Zininjor, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Magna.
Well, listeners, we want to know what you think about this it feels like a historic Super Tuesday for both Democrats and Republicans. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let us know what you think about this day, about politics in Massachusetts, and about where the nation heads from here as we find out what results are later this evening. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also always send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Now, no matter what the results are from today's Super Tuesday contest, there will be enormous questions lingering over the Republican Party specifically. You heard us talk a little earlier about the questions surrounding Donald Trump and whether or not he's upending what we conceive of as the traditional GOP. Now, conservatives from Glenn Beck to Bill Kristol have come out against Donald Trump, warning that his victory could mean something disastrous for the Republican Party. Bill Kristol wrote recently in the National Review, quote, "Isn't Trumpism a two-bit Caesarianism of a kind that American conservatives have always disdained?" Referring there to Julius Caesar, I believe. And David Frum took to Twitter to ask, "Isn't the point here that if a great political party is so vulnerable to fraud as obvious as Trump, it was unhealthy to start with?" Well, we want to put this election in historical context now, specifically the crossroads that the GOP finds itself in. To help us do that, we're joined by Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, a book tracing the history of the Republican Party. Professor Richardson, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
So tell us, we talked to you before the current presidential primary season got underway. I never thought how prescient that was going to be. Have we seen a contest like this in recent memory?
Not really. You could say that the 1964 Goldwater campaign was similar to this, but this is really the election in many ways since the turn of the last century. This is the election for our generation and the generation above us and below us, and this will be the one from which we will be dating everything going forward.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so tell me more about that. I mean, why do you think it stands out? I mean, from your historical view, more than any other in the past 100 years.
Because people are focusing right now on the split within the candidates who are running currently for the Republican Party. And for example, you just talked about how the people who run the National Review are horrified by Trump, and Trump voters are horrified by the National Review. And there is within that branch of the Republican Party a real split between the establishment and Trump and what the two stand for. But people tend to forget that there is also another older split in the Republican Party that really took root in the 1990s and reached back at least to the 1980s, and actually all the way back to the 1950s. And that was a split between moderate Republicans, what many people think is the real Republican Party, and the movement conservatives who took it over, starting with Reagan, but really taking off in the 1990s. Right now, those movement conservatives are slashing and burning and crashing. And this is the moment when the Republican Party is going to either disappear or go down the road that Trump is offering, or reform itself. And there's a lot of people who think this is the moment that the Republican Party is going to be reborn.
So in a sense, actually, I mean, that leads me to a question I've been dying to ask you all day. I mean, it's easy for us to say Donald Trump is signifying the end of the GOP as we know it, but couldn't it possibly be exactly the opposite? Is he doing a favor to the Republican Party by refocusing the party on the actual needs, concerns, values, desires of a base that many people see the party itself having ignored for some time?
Well, the papers today would suggest that. There's a lot of people writing in a lot of places that this is the magical moment. I will say that I think long term that's absolutely right. I think 2020 is the year to be watching for the Republican Party. I will say between now and 2020, we've got ourselves four fairly ugly years coming up. And that concerns me a lot. Trump isn't doing anybody any favors in the short term, that's for sure.
Okay, so ugly years in terms of the GOP trying to figure itself out or you know, for the nation as a whole?
Well, listen, Trump would not be popular were he not speaking to a population that thinks he's great. And if you think of the xenophobia and the racism and the sexism that he is embodying and that he is whipping up people to fall behind and to embrace, I don't see where that anger goes in the short term, because in the upcoming first nomination but then election, these people are not going to get what they want. And where is that anger going to go?
Well, let's take a step back here, because I want to go back to a century, because as you said, it's the most consequential election in your mind in the past 100 years. Because, you know, remind us of what the economic and social factors were around. Are you speaking of the Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party run? Which one are you talking about?
Well,
here?
It's interesting you say that. The parallels that I see are to the rise of Teddy Roosevelt. And I'm not suggesting Trump is Teddy Roosevelt, just the opposite. But that Teddy Roosevelt came out of a moment that looked very much like this current election does. And that was the election of 1884, when the Republican Party then also split. A number of Republicans said they could not back the candidate who had risen to the top of the Republican Party. And they switched parties and voted for the Democrat. And when that happened, people within the Republican Party said, we cannot continue to go down the road we're going, being a big business party that does not speak for average Americans. We must reform it. And those people were Teddy Roosevelt, Bob La Follette, Cabot Lodge, the people who went on to create the Progressive Republican Party.
Stand by for just a moment, Heather Cox Richardson, because I want to take a call that's speaking to exactly this point. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're not just talking about the GOP through this whole hour. We want your impressions about Super Tuesday itself and how the nation moves forward from here and the rest of the presidential race. But if you do have some thoughts about the state of the Republican Party now and the crisis it finds itself in, 800-423-8255 is the number to call. Let's go to Lorne, who's calling from Lincoln. You're on the air, Lorne.
Hi. I'm kind of a traditional progressive Republican, and this election cycle, I have been so frightened by the candidates my party has advanced and the nature of the base of the party these days that there is absolutely no way I can vote Republican anymore. I just voted for Hillary Clinton.
Really?
I believe that not only the fate of the Republican Party depends on this coming election, but the fate of the Republic.
So, Lauren, can you forgive me for cutting you off there, Lauren? But can you tell me more about How would you like to see the GOP, evolve from this or change or move forward?
I can't help but think, but during the Reagan years, Reagan brought in the religious conservatives. And the religious conservatives bring with them their religious reasoning, which is intolerant and inflexible and absolutist, which goes against the nature of American democracy. And it's drugged the party farther and farther to the right. The Republican Party, in order to be a functioning party in the context of a two-party system, needs to return to a centrist position like Teddy Roosevelt, like Bush the Elder.
Lauren, I'm gonna take it back from you there because I want to get Heather Cox Richardson's thoughts on that. But thank you so very much for your call from Lincoln. Heather, what's your thought on that?
Well, it's wonderful to hear this because I think there is this groundswell across the country looking at the party and worrying about it. I would say back to Lauren that it seems to me historically that the Democrats, considering when they rose and the patterns that they've put together since then, have traditionally spoken as a group of people who see the world as divided between the haves and the have-nots, and they work to make the government help even the playing field, and sometimes we need that very badly. But the Republicans rose at a different time, and they tend to see the world as a web in which if people at the bottom do well, people at the top also do well. The problem is that theory, it's very easy for people in power to turn that language around and make that sort of ideology serve only the very wealthy, and when that happens, the Republicans are at their worst. But if the Republicans regained their old ground, they would, in fact, be able to be born again.
So let me ask you, is the possibility for some kind of, internal transformation to the Republican Party truly possible today and still have it be called the Republican Party in the way that you were talking about happened a century ago? Because I'm wondering, There are significant differences, obviously, in the intervening 100 years. Some would point to, there's the influence of money in politics might prevent or slow down the pace of change even within a party.
Absolutely, but this is not the first time we've been here. There are differences today than there are in the past. We have two new unique things today. But in the past, certainly you can't say the 1890s looked all that much different than the present or the 1920s. In both cases, the Republican Party was absolutely run by the wealthiest people in the country, and they were organizing the government to serve them. And in both of those cases, the party reorganized from the bottom up and became the progressive eras that we tend to think of quite positively.
Okay, another question about that. Did it require losing the White House and Congress? Because it doesn't seem, as if anyone's saying that Congress is going to change hands here this time around.
No, and that's one of the differences nowadays is the gerrymandering of the Congress is extraordinary right now. In all of those cases, what precipitated it was an economic crash, 1893, the 1929 one, and then, of course, you could argue 2008. In all of those cases, it was within the Republican Party that operatives recognized that the party could no longer win elections. And in order, at first, what they tried to do was to mess around with the electorate, mess around with voting rules, try and keep Democrats from voting, trying to gerrymander, trying to put more money into politics to buy elections, buying up newspapers to promote propaganda. But in every case, there came a time when especially younger people in the party said, this is no longer viable. We can no longer get the votes and still have a democracy. And in each of those cases, younger people in the party stepped forward and said, we've got to rework the way we do business.
Let's take another call here. Irfan is calling from Sharon. You're on the air.
Hi. I voted, actually, by the way, this afternoon in Sharon, Massachusetts, and I talked to the election officials, and they said that this is the highest turnout they have seen in the last 30 years. And political point that I wanted to make is I think mainstream media definitely has to move on beyond talking about only two-party system, because in near future, I think there has to be multi-party control, and I would like to know what your expert has to say on that.
Great question, Irfan. I was wondering about that, too. Instead of just having sort of revolution and reform within the Republican Party or even the Democratic Party, I mean, there's an equal amount of discontent we're seeing there. Why not have this be the moment for a viable third party to begin its emergence?
Well, I'm not saying it's not going to happen. It just never really has happened in American history. We get third parties, but what they tend to do is they tend to pull the major parties in one direction or another. And there are actually structural reasons for that happening in America. It's a very odd system we have. But the argument is that if you think about it, most Americans do fall into a large middle consensus, unlike in many countries. And again, there's a historical argument that that comes out of our Civil War. We worry too much about anybody becoming too extreme because we know where that goes, and we didn't like it very much when it happened.
Mm. And I guess my final question to you to bring it back to Donald Trump. I mean, at the beginning of this primary season, I didn't think he'd last long, and obviously, I hold my hand up as being completely wrong about that. For everyone else who thought the same thing, now we're all wondering, we should have seen this coming. I mean, is that a fair statement to say that there has been, that he is responding to, a certain discontent that has been very legitimately building up amongst people for quite some time?
I think it was there, and I think I didn't see it coming only because I thought he'd lose interest. I thought he had the attention span of a gnat and he was going to go away. But in fact, what he has identified is he's a salesman. He's basically speaking to a population that has been created over the past 30 years and that has learned to blame people of color, women, immigrants for their own discontent. And that's language that has come from within the movement conservatives who took over the Republican Party. And during Obama's administration, it has come from people in power in the Republican Party. The senators and congressmen have really pushed this. And I think that's absolutely unforgivable. But this was a perfect storm, but it was a perfect storm absolutely waiting to happen.
Hmm. Well, Heather Cox Richardson is a professor of history at Boston College, and she's the author of To Make Men Free, an absolutely fascinating book tracing the history of the Republican Party. You're going to have to add some chapters to the book now, I think.
Every minute.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, we're going to take your calls a little more in the remainder of the hour. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Tell us what you think about this Super Tuesday, this historic one. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking Super Tuesday this hour. Voters casting their ballots in 13 states today, including Massachusetts and Vermont. New England Public Radio senior news reporter Kari Njiri has been going to polling places in and around Springfield this afternoon. She's outside a polling place in West Springfield and joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Kari.
Thank you, Meghna.
It's great to talk with you. And let us know, what have you been seeing today? What's turnout been like?
Well, it's been interesting. I first started in the mid-morning in Springfield, and the turnout at a couple of the polling places I've visited were low. In fact, one had fewer than 90 people casting ballots by a quarter to 12. However, I did move on to Holyoke and West Springfield, and polling places that I visited there, it seemed like the turnout had picked up. You could see a steady stream of cars going in and out, and people, of course, going in and out to the ballot boxes. I talked with the election commissioner in Holyoke, who had projected a 20 to 25% turnout. Just a few minutes ago, she says it's at 18%, but she still thinks that it will get to that 20-25% figure after the work dinner time rush, but not as high as the 37% turnout that occurred in 2008. In West Springfield, they projected a 15% turnout at about 1 o'clock, but the city clerk there tells me that if everything stays consistent, it should reach the 30% turnout he originally projected.
Mm-hmm. And Kari, before I ask you our next question, I do have to apologize for saying she rather than he when I introduced you earlier. If it makes you feel any better, Governor John Kasich called me Jamie yesterday when my name's Meghna. So I suppose we all have our off moments. But anyway, so you've been speaking to voters as well. What issues are resonating with them? What issues have brought them to the polls to cast their ballots today?
Well, aside from those that said it was their civic duty to come out and cast a vote, some of the issues that folks were willing to talk about were the economy, terrorism to a lesser degree, but actually a couple more than a few people talked about the influence of big money on politics. And that's why they were coming out to vote. Interestingly, one person said he voted for Bernie Sanders for that reason, and another said they were voting for Donald Trump for the very same reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kari Njiri is senior news reporter for New England Public Radio, speaking to us just outside a polling place in West Springfield. Delight to speak with you, Kari. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Magna.
All right, thank you. Let's take a quick call here. Desmond is calling from Lowell. You're on the air, Desmond. Hey, Desmond, can you hear me now? Desmond, you're on the air. Can you hear me? All right. Well, Desmond, if you get back on the line, we'll try to get you on the air here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Tanya, who's calling from Concord. You're on the air, Tanya.
Hello. A lot. You were asking before about how we couldn't figure out that Donald Trump would have come this far. And one observation I have about that is that he was not stopped effectively in the beginning by the media, not because of his ideas, most of which are unrealistic, but because of the rhetoric that was quite racist and ended up, in fact, causing some violent incidents, like a homeless person being attacked for being Hispanic. I think the media was not focusing on his actions and on his words strongly enough. Instead of worrying about whether he would be a likely candidate or not, the point should have been in stopping inadmissible speech in our public rhetoric.
So Tanya, thank you so much for your thoughts today, and thank you for your call. I think we've got Desmond from Lowell back, so let's see if we can get him on the line. Desmond, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much for accepting my call. I am a supporter of Hillary Clinton. And I just come from the polling station. I just voted for her for one or many reasons. Hillary stands for everybody, not only for Democrats, but she's there for everybody of the United States.
And
as a result, she's there for healthcare.
Desmond, your line is really kind of tough to hear. So I was wondering if you had a thought about the race overall.
Okay, I'm very sorry. I don't know where I am. I don't really know what's wrong with it, but my phone is okay. I'm sorry for that.
That's okay, Desmond. In fact, I'm going to have to just take it back from you there because it's really tough to hear your call, but I appreciate you giving us a ring today. That's Desmond from Lowell. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We'll keep our fingers crossed that cell phone lines will get better from our other callers here. But let's turn now to Vermont, which is also casting ballots today in Super Tuesday and will award delegates based on those results. And to help us get the view from Vermont, we're joined by Jane Lindholm, host of Vermont Edition, a daily news magazine and call-in program on Vermont Public Radio. Jane, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Magna. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. It's like a wonderful New England connection here. I love doing it.
I know, but who gets to interview who? I should be interviewing you.
Oh, my gosh. No. I think Vermont's a far more interesting place right now than the Radio Boston studio, let me put it that way. All right. So you aired your program today at noon and heard from Vermonters on this Super Tuesday. What have they been telling you about this election?
You know, they've been telling us a lot, and not just today, as you can imagine. It's been a topic of much conversation in Vermont ever since Bernie Sanders started thinking about running several months ago now. So Vermonters are paying very close attention, and it won't surprise you to hear that it sounds like we're going to have a very, very big turnout for Bernie Sanders. VPR did a poll recently with the Castleton Polling Institute, and it sounded like likely Democratic voters were going to go for Bernie Sanders at 80%.
Oh, one wonders why it actually isn't even higher than that.
Yes. Well, you know, 80%, I mean, that's pretty darn high. He does win in the 70s often when he's running for Senate, but 80% in a presidential primary is pretty good, even in Vermont.
Yeah. And so tell us a little bit more about how Vermonters... Oh, actually, let me just ask you. I mean, is this an interesting moment for Vermonters vis-a-vis the fact that by virtue of Sanders' campaign. There's been a lot more attention being paid to his career in Vermont and how he's represented the state.
It is. I think for many Vermonters, it's a little bit humorous because we are very familiar as a state with Bernie Sanders. We have reelected him by wide margins in the last several elections. He was the mayor of Burlington many years ago. I mean, he's been a figure in the state for a long time. And so to see the rest of the United States sort of come to Bernie Sanders and grapple with his tough exterior and is he a curmudgeonly grandpa or is he, you know, a savior for the middle class is something that Vermonters have always been talking about and thinking about in regards to Bernie Sanders. So seeing the rest of the country suddenly come to him is a little bit humorous, but also I think for many Vermonters who support him, really nice to see that support from other parts of the country.
Mm. So tell me a little bit more. I mean, do Vermonters, not that they're a monolithic bloc or anything, but do they see Senator Sanders as curmudgeonly, lovable? What's their view?
I think both. I mean,
I will tell you,
from my perspective as a reporter, Senator Sanders is the only politician who's ever hung up on me. But he is also the politician who told me that one time he was not curmudgeonly. He said, Jane, I'm a gentle soul. So, you know, you sort of get a sense of humor from him. You definitely, I think, get a sense for many Vermonters believe he is a warrior for them. Vermont has a high level of participation in the National Guard, and we had a lot of deployments. So I think Senator Sanders' record on military issues is also something that Vermonters pay really close attention to.
Huh. Well, let me ask you, because of Senator Sanders' campaign, I wonder if the rest of the nation has an accurate view of Vermont, you know, by virtue of it might seem as if Vermont's this ultra-left, super-liberal place and has been as such forever. But that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, I mean, I think many of us think or many Vermonters believe that the rest of the country sees Vermont as the land of Ben and Jerry's and cows. And maybe there's an association with same-sex marriage since Vermont was the first state to pass civil unions and the first state to vote in same-sex marriage through a legislature. Maybe people think about snowboarding, maybe not this year, fall foliage. But I think Vermont as a political space is often just seen as a one-note kind of state. And until 1962, Vermont never elected a single Democrat to the governor's office. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Vermont was really a rock-ribbed Republican state up until fairly recently. And even now, Vermont tends to go back and forth with the governor's seat, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. So I think there's more nuance than a lot of people in other parts of the country see.
Yeah. Well, on that note, final question to you, Jane. I'm seeing a Vermont Public Radio poll that was released yesterday that showed on the Republican side of things, Donald Trump leading in Vermont with a sizable lead over Marco Rubio or Senator Ted Cruz. We were just talking here on our show yesterday that Vermont would be a good test for Ohio Governor John Kasich, though.
Yeah, you know, that's so interesting. And the VPR poll came out, I think, a week or two now ago, but it was conducted from February 3rd through the 17th. And during that time period when there were sort of rolling call-outs for the Republican candidates and the Democrats, Donald Trump's popularity in Vermont increased. It started in the early days of February at about 20%. And after the New Hampshire primary, his support rose to about 40% among likely Republican voters, according to the poll. So, you know, I think some people will be surprised or may be surprised if it goes the way the poll suggested to see Vermont Republicans voting for Donald Trump. But John Kasich has really been making a push here. He's been in the state twice just in the last couple of weeks. So We'll have to see what happens.
Well, Jane Lindholm is host of Vermont Edition, a daily news magazine and call-in program on Vermont Public Radio. It was great to talk with you, Jane. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have to do this again.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's take some calls here because we've got a lot of them. Chris is calling from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, Chris.
Hi. Yes, I'm just outside the polling, my polling station. I'm about to go vote for Bernie Sanders. And I think the reason I feel so strongly about him is that he's been really constant on the side of justice and really standing up for working people. And I think a lot of my folks who are older, don't understand why 80% of the youth are supporting him. The system really has been rigged for them, and we need big change. And the only way that's going to happen is if people get very involved, mm-hmm. not just in the election. As he says, it's not about me, it's about we. And it's really about keeping people involved.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to take it back from you because I want to get the voices of some other callers in here, but I appreciate it very much. Hannah's calling from Worcester. You're on the air, Hannah.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for taking my call. I just kind of wanted to raise the issue. I'm actually about to go vote for Bernie as well and agree with our previous caller, Chris. But I'd like to know, for those who are supporting Donald Trump, or just raise the issue, a lot of people say that he supports, you know, he raises a lot of ideas, you know, that the common man, you know, is upset about in America, and that's why he's got so much, you know, momentum. But I would like to understand, because, you know, from my point of view, Donald Trump isn't your neighbor or your mailman or, you know, he's part of that 1%. So I would like to know where that kind of scheme is coming from, because Donald Trump, you know, he's really not
right.
just your average American fighting for the cause.
Well, Hannah, I'm going to take your question back from you, because I'm sorry to cut you off here. I'm going to take it back because we got to take a break here. But I think I would love to find out the answer to your question as well. So I'm going to turn it back to listeners out there, Massachusetts Republicans, independents, anyone who cast their ballot for Donald Trump today. Listener Hannah is wondering, why did you do that? I would love to hear from you. So give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Give us a call or send us a tweet. We're at Radio Boston. We'll be right back in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty on this Super Tuesday. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty and our Super Tuesday special, if I can call it that. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Give us a call and let us know what you think of this election day, this primary day, how the nation moves forward, what you think is going to happen next in this historic presidential race. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Would love to hear from voters of all stripes across the state of Massachusetts. Well, let's turn now to Texas, where we're joined by Peniel Joseph. He was founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. He's now professor of public affairs and history at the University of Texas at Austin. Their gain, our loss, but he's the founding director of UT Austin's Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and author of a number of books, including Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Professor Joseph, it's great to have you back on the show.
Hey, Meghna. Great to be here.
So you're no longer here in Massachusetts. You're in Texas, in Austin. What have you seen unfolding there? They're also voting today.
Yeah, Texas is a very, very interesting state and place to be in to discuss politics. And so, you know, Austin is as well, because Austin is in a lot of ways a blue jewel amidst the vast red sea in the state of Texas. So you have real fiery and passionate debates vis-a-vis Clinton versus Bernie Sanders on a Democratic side. And on the Republican side, it's really been a slugfest between supporters of Ted Cruz, who is the senator here, one of the two senators here, and Marco Rubio, but also obviously Donald Trump. And it's very interesting, the discussion you were having earlier about Trump, because I think the Trump phenomena is so extraordinarily interesting for people who discuss politics and presidential history, and especially race, because I agree with the previous guest, Professor Richardson, about it predating Barry Goldwater and really going back to Tom Watson and the populists in a way. But I think when we think about the way in which the GOP gets realigned from its roots as the party of Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt and sort of Nelson Rockefeller, I think 64 is incredibly key in terms of understanding Trump. But the interesting part about Trump is that he's such an amalgamation of not just Republican, but Democratic politics, and in this case, Dixiecratic politics. And so I think he's an extraordinary figure. And I agree with Professor Richardson in the sense that after this election, there's going to be sort of a before the 2016 election and after, especially if, as it seems all likely to be, he's the Republican nominee.
Right. Well, so Peniel, let me ask you. I mean, there has never really been an American election where issues of race haven't been important. That's a triple negative, if I may. But race is always at the center of the American conversation.
Absolutely.
As it should be. I want to play a little bit of tape here because it's not just an issue on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side as well. But as we're on the issue of the GOP, I want to play a little bit of tape of what happened a little earlier today on Capitol Hill because, you know, as you know, one of the recent controversies that Donald Trump has faced was he received support from former KKK leader David Duke, and it took him some days to issue some sort of rebuke of that support. And some people say he still hasn't fully disavowed David Duke's support. Donald Trump hasn't. Well, earlier today, House Speaker Paul Ryan said that even though he's tried to stay out of the primary fray, he couldn't after what happened with Trump and the KKK. So here's what he said.
If a person wants to be the nominee of the Republican Party, there can be no evasion and no games. They must reject any group or cause that is built on bigotry. This party does not prey on people's prejudices. This is the party of Lincoln. We believe all people are created equal in the eyes of God and our government. This is fundamental.
That's earlier today, House Speaker Paul Ryan speaking. I mean, Peniel Joseph, what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily disingenuous, and it's also ahistorical because this really isn't the party of Lincoln. What's so interesting about American history is that in the 1960s, because of the civil rights movement, the parties switched. Sometimes the big word for this is realignment. And the reason they realigned, and you had Southern Democrats primarily who made up the New Deal coalition, and sometimes people call them Dixiecrats. And we're thinking about people like Senator Jim Eastland, Richard Russell. Some of them were mentors to U.S. presidents. We're thinking about people who switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party in the aftermath of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act. So what's interesting about the Republican Party, which was, when we think about the post-war period and the New Deal period, really a minority party. It was a party of basically representing a sort of a fiscal conservatism. It also had relatively liberal Northeastern progressives in the sense of Nelson Rockefeller and people like that. But it was a minority party.
Yeah.
The way in which they become a majority party, and remember, we have the Nixon advisor, Kevin Phillips, who maps out this realignment strategy.
Right.
And this realignment takes really decades to occur at the local level. At the national level in 1968, Richard Nixon wins the presidency, but many of the Trump voters that we're seeing and the people are going to call Reagan Democrats, about 9 million vote for the former governor of Alabama, George Wallace, who was an open segregationist.
Right.
And the interesting part about this history is that if we roll back the clock to 1948, four people run for president. It's going to be Thomas Dewey, who's governor of New York. It's going to be Harry Truman, who's the president of the United States, but is trying to win a term in his own right because he only becomes president after FDR dies of a massive cerebral brain hemorrhage in April of 1945. And it's going to be Henry Wallace, who was FDR's former vice president and a very progressive, very much like in the Bernie Sanders vein. And it's going to be Strom Thurmond, who's a senator from South Carolina. And there's a point he's governor of South Carolina,
yeah,
who walks out of the Democratic National Convention and runs as a state's right candidate, sometimes called the Dixiecrats.
Yeah.
The interesting part about that is that Thurmond and Wallace both get 3 million votes, but Strom Thurmond gets really a couple hundred thousand more votes than Wallace. And of course, Truman is elected,
yeah,
in his own right. So we flash forward to 1980 and 84. And this is where Reagan and Reaganism is so important. Reagan.
Peniel, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I want to continue that thought. But we have some callers that I want to get to, too. And then we can't forget that we must talk about race and the Democrats, because that's an important part of the race on that side, too. But we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You're hearing Professor Peniel Joseph. He's the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts, and he's now professor of public affairs and history at the University of Texas at Austin. And again, we're at 800-423-8255-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Trent, who's calling from Leominster. You're on the air, Trent.
Hi. I just got done voting for Trump, And I initially, when I saw that guy walk down those stairs or go down the escalator, I thought there's no way I was going to vote for this guy. But
what changed your mind?
I went through all the websites and read what all the different candidates were, saying. And Trump's discussion of immigration absolutely rang true for me because, I think it's not just immigration. I think the effects that he's proposing, I think the effects will have be on the economy as well. So mm-hmm. It's economy and immigration, there. Everybody's talking about the wages being stagnated and things. I think what he's proposing is a way to increase those wages, and I don't think he's as pro, corporation as everybody gives him, thinks of him.
Right. Trent, let me take it back from you, but I really, really, really do appreciate your call. I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I do want to get another call here from Mike, who's calling from Chelmsford. You're on the air, Mike.
Yes. Just wanted to offer a little insight into the mind of a Trump voter. So many people are disgusted with the status quo, legalized bribery, and they see in Trump somebody who's the antithesis of the status quo. Now, unfortunately, Trump will say everything. He'll say things that are left-wing, he'll say things that are right-wing. And they'll contradict each other often. But people use him as a vessel for their hopes and dreams for change.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he's not that change that they think he is. And I would encourage all Trump voters to take a look at Bernie Sanders. He is not establishment, and he's not a billionaire who's going to use this system to improve his own personal game.
Mike, thank you so much for your call. Peniel Joseph, let me go back to you just here for a quick minute before we have to wrap up. You heard from a couple voters there. Just your last thought. I'm afraid I'm almost flat out of time.
Well, I mean, I think this is the kind of populism that you see where people are angry about inequality. And in a way, Trump and the articulation of a kind of populism that's going to make America great again, it's going to take us back to a time where there was a white working class making money in the industrial trades. There weren't all these feminists criticizing America's rape culture. There wasn't all these black people who were demanding citizenship. There was no such thing in that context as LGBT and transgendered rights. So I think he's galvanized a group of white Americans who last consolidated under Reagan.
Right.
I think it's interesting that he had the great big rally in Alabama and Jeff Sessions supported him, but also NASCAR. I mean, he's getting the NASCAR vote. And what's interesting about this is that he's also dividing the Republican Party in the process. So sometimes mm-hmm. people say this is going to be a close election. I think it's going to be a tremendously important election. But certainly if the Democratic coalition that elected Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, the two largest political votes in American history, 69 million and then close to 66 million, if they come out again, it's going to be no contest mm-hmm. because the base of the Republican Party is not unified. So Trump is going to bring millions of new voters in. But really, the base who voted for Romney and George W. Bush and who voted for McCain, there's millions who actually will not vote for Trump.
Well, Peniel Joseph, professor of politics and public affairs and history at the University of Texas, Austin. Great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, we have 1 minute left here, and Anthony Brooks, WBR senior political reporter, has magically appeared back in the studio. What's your thoughts at the end of the hour, Anthony?
Final thought in 30 seconds. This is without doubt the most fascinating political season I've ever watched. The first one was Bill Clinton's first race, but here we have two contests that are really about fighting for the heart and soul of these two political parties, and one of these parties might be unrecognizable when this contest is over. Yeah. So that's what I'm thinking about.
So we'll see what happens. And I know you've got a lot of work ahead of you tonight. So thanks for coming back in the studio, Anthony.
My pleasure.
WBR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks there. And callers, thank you for calling and letting us know what you think of this Super Tuesday and how you voted and what you want next for American democracy. Keep that conversation going. Send us tweets. We're at Radio Boston. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Super Tuesday. This is Radio Boston.